Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. We have a fantastic show for you tonight. Mr. Mark Klass will join us here momentarily. And later in the show, Donna Anderson, we're going to talk all about sociopaths and why you don't want them anywhere in your life. Trust me. Today's show is brought to you by Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer a therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. It's really a cool program. Go to www.pauseforpurplehearts.org. Legal Goo Time, opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and do remember, Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuths.com, LLC, and formsforjustice.org. Now, what is on everybody's mind? It's the missing plane, right? Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Now, some more debris has been found in the Indian Ocean. It's about the same size. It's really big. About the same size as the previous pieces that have been found. But on my upcoming iHeart show on Thursday, I am going to have an airline captain on who knows his stuff. He really knows his stuff. And he will be able to answer all of your questions. He knows everything about the cockpit. He knows the whole deal. Here's the problem. He won't know until Tuesday whether he can for sure do my iHeartRadio show on Thursday. So he says he's 90% sure, so I told him I would 90% promote him. So I won't tell you his name until I know for sure he's going to be on the show, but keep that in mind. Thursday, 90% chance. We're going to have a lot of questions answered about that missing airline flight. Right now, though, let's go out to a dear friend of ours, Mr. Mark Klass from the Klass Kids Foundation. Mark, how are you? Whoops, hold on. Wait a second. Mark, just a second. You're not talking. Hold on. That's my fault. Hi, Mark. Sorry about that.
Hi, Trisha. How are you?
I am great. How are you doing?
Good. I'm good. Good. Thank you very much.
Good. We have some good news here. Let's start with the good news, and then we're going to go for the not-so-good news. You have something that is so amazing. It's called Polly's Guardian Angel. And really briefly, in case you have been living in a Taliban cave, Mark Klass's daughter, Polly, was kidnapped and murdered. And since then, Mark has devoted his life to making sure our kids are safe. Now, you have something called Polly's Guardian Angel application or app. What's this about?
Well, it's a smartphone app, and it's available in both iPhone and Android versions. And it's really the nation's first parent-initiated missing child alert system. So if you have it loaded onto your phone and you have your child's personal and private information on it, which incidentally stays only on the app itself, and your child disappears for any reason, you can hit that app, and anybody else with the app within a certain radius, say a 7-mile radius, will immediately be notified that your child is missing. So you can get this out into the community faster than law enforcement can. But then beyond that, if you haven't called law enforcement, the app prompts you to do so within 10 minutes. If you still haven't located your child within 30 minutes, you're prompted to contact our organization, where we'll have an expert walk you through the relevant steps until you have a resolution.
That is amazing. When was this developed? You must have been developing this for a long time.
Well, we actually made it available in January of 2013, so it's been out there for just a little over a year now.
And how's it going? Are people starting to use it and pick up on it?
Some people are using it. Yeah, we're not getting the kind of we're not getting the kind of leverage with it, or traction, I should say, that we had hoped to get. But you know what? It's still very early in the game, and it's still the best product of its type out there, giving a lot of tools to parents, giving them the ability to get that out into the community very quickly. And so, you know, we're still optimistic.
Well, yeah, on something like that, it does take a long time because it's new, and people need to know that they can go to the app on their phone and do that, and that's something that we haven't been able to do before, so it is going to take time for people to get that ingrained in their memories, but we'll help you any way we can, Mark. We'll certainly do our part to get the word out there about this amazing application. So
well,
now,
thank you,
You're welcome. Now that we've talked about the really good stuff, now the stuff that is so annoying, it just makes me crazy. You posted on Facebook, let me find it here. You said, first AB 109, then three strikes reversal, then Governor Brown allows 1,400 lifers to be paroled, and now this, I detect a dangerous trend. And you're talking that this is the downgrading or actually removing of some sex offenders on the list. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, exactly. The Sex Offender Management Board, which is under California's Department of Corrections and Parole, is promoting an idea of instead of having lifetime sex offender registration in California, that certain what they call low-level sex offenders be removed after serving only or being registered for only 10 years or in some cases 20 years. And what they say is that it will allow certain people to get on with their lives and they won't be living under the stigma of Megan's Law. What they don't tell you is that of the 106,000 registered sex offenders in the state of California, only about two-thirds of those are subject to the provisions of Megan's Law to begin with. So you've mm-hmm. already got one-third that don't even count because you can't find out who they are easily, and they want to lessen those rules even more. And when I say a trend, Tricia, there has been a trend since Governor Brown came into office. AB 109, also known as prison realignment, took the responsibility for tens of thousands of prisoners away from the state and put them in the counties so that the sheriffs either had to incarcerate them in their already overcrowded jails or put them on some kind of a conditional release, which mm-hmm. they were unprepared to deal with to begin with. And that's resulted in some pretty heinous recidivism. These were supposed to be non-sexual, non-serious, non-violent guys, but some of them have gone on to some terrible crimes. Then in November of 2012, the citizens of California, after a very well-financed campaign, decided to overturn California's three strikes law, which mm-hmm. then allowed up to 3,600 three strikes prisoners, which is almost half of the three strikes prisoners who are supposed to be in there at least 25 years to life, to get out much earlier than otherwise would have been possible. And now and then, since Governor Brown has been in office since 2011, he has allowed three times as many lifers to gain early release through parole as did his three predecessors combined. Now they want to do this business with the sex offenders, and I just see a real trend about towards going soft on criminals, and it alarms me. It alarms me tremendously.
Now, some of these, if I could just play devil's advocate here for a moment, Mark,
yeah,
some
sure.
of these people that they want to take off the list, couldn't some of them be, you know, a 17-year-old that had sex with a 16-year-old girlfriend, somebody caught urinating in public, something that is not really you should worry about? Isn't that what they're talking about when they say they're letting these other people just get off the list to have a life?
Listen, nobody that is in that situation is currently subjected to Megan's Law.
Okay.
The Romeo and Juliet situations, the guy that took a leak on the fire plug, these are not guys that you are going to be able to find out about by logging on to Megan's Law right now. If they are registered sex offenders, they are not subject to that kind of scrutiny. In other words, they just aren't subject to Megan's Law. These are people that the sheriff knows about. These are not people that the public knows about. But that having been said, I mean, Californians are very clear as to what they want done to these people. And I see that in many of these cases, and I guess the one exception would be over the overturning of three strikes, is that these are unilateral decisions that are being made either by the governor of California or people working at his behest.
So let's take the lowest possible person on the list that is subject to Megan's Law. What did that person have to, what type of crime did that person have to commit to be subject to Megan's Law restrictions? Give us an idea of what type of offender we're talking about.
Well, a child pornographer. How about a child pornographer? How does that mm-hmm. sit with you? You know, those are...
Not at all.
These are
not good.
These are considered, yeah, these are considered very low-level sex offenders. The problem is that many of the people that are serving time or that are on the Megan's Law site have pled down from their original crime to begin with. And we find that in 90% of all criminal justice cases, you know, there's a plea bargain that's engaged so that you don't have to take the trial or you don't have to take the case to trial to begin with. So somebody might be pleading down from a child pornography charge, but that certainly doesn't mean that that is what that individual was arrested for in the first place, nor does that necessarily signify that that's the only crime that that individual has ever committed. Because this whole thing is presumed on the fact that we catch somebody in the commission of their first crime and punish them accordingly, and I think everybody mm-hmm. understands that that's not the truth.
Exactly. Well, I think it's also very easy to understand that when somebody is finally caught with child pornography or abusing someone, it isn't their first time either. They are just, it's just because they've been caught that they're stopped. This certainly wasn't their first time. They've probably been going at it a long time, depending on how old they are, right?
Well, yeah, there's no question about that. And I think we have to be really clear about this. I mean, California, back in the early 90s when Pauly was murdered and Megan was murdered, Megan's Law, mm-hmm. Megan was murdered, and so many other of the historical cases that we're aware of, crime was at an all-time high in our country, and it was very much on people's minds. It was certainly on the minds of people in the state of California, where we had, in fact, the strictest three strikes law that was initiated in the aftermath of many of these crimes, and mm-hmm. even in the federal government. It's one thing that President Clinton and the Republican majority in the House were able to agree on was that crime was rampant and something needed to be done about it. So at the state level, we initiated three strikes. We initiated truth in sentencing. At the federal level, the president put 100,000 cops on the streets. He gave the states $10 billion to make more prisons. If they initiated truth in sentencing laws, and he put $6.5 billion into state coffers to provide prevention programs for at-risk youth. And as a mm-hmm. result of those initiatives, crime was cut significantly across the board in the United States. In California, the crime rate was halved within just a couple of years.
Oh, my God.
So hard restrictions on criminals and holding criminals accountable for the crimes that they committed resulted in a tremendous drop in the crime rate. And now we're seeing the pendulum swing the other way with the enthusiastic endorsement, apparently, of our governor. And I just think that this is something that people should be paying attention to.
Well, I think it's very, very bizarre. Now, somebody just gave me this statistic, Mark, and this is very troubling. On an average, a sex offender will assault over 80 people before they are caught. Does that sound about right to you?
Oh, I've heard that number, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of studies that are out there, and, you know, they'll say 40 people, 50 people, 80 people, but the point mm-hmm. is that, you know, there's a whole slew of victims in these characters' wake. And to think that, you know, they get off with a slap in the hand while their victims are spending the rest of their lives going through therapy and otherwise trying to put their lives together, I think is demeaning the crime and demeaning the effect that these crimes have on victims.
I'm still very puzzled about the three strikes law, why that was overturned. I know there was a massive media campaign concerning it, but I've never understood what is the good thing about this. Now, let's keep in mind, we're talking about, guys, it's up to the judge. The judge has a lot of discretion in this three strikes, you're outlaw. And that discretion being, I'm going to sentence you under the three strikes, you're outlaw, or not. So it's not like they have these rigid guidelines. And basically, so the guy gets two, you know, violent felonies, and then he commits a third felony, and it's up to the judge whether to sentence him under the three strikes, you're outlaw. And if he judge sentences him, then boom, three strikes, you're out. You get 25 to life. But that didn't sit well with people, and I'm just puzzled. And maybe you can paint the picture here of what I'm not seeing. How in the world can anybody have a problem with that?
Well, it's even beyond what you're saying, Tricia, because before the judge even sees the case, the prosecutor has a discretion as to whether or not to charge as a third strike. So what you have, and here's the problem, and here's how this whole thing gets twisted. You have somebody that has committed or been sentenced for two serious and or violent crimes through the course of their criminal history and has spent some time in the California prison system. And you're dealing, first of all, with a pretty bad character. It's hard to get sent to prison in California to begin with. But that's what you're dealing with. So the law is very clear. It says, okay, so now you have options. Now you're back on the streets, and you have the choice of either living a lawful life, living within the boundaries of our society, and or putting yourself out there and realizing that if you commit another crime, that you could then spend 25 years to life for that crime, regardless of how serious it is, as long as it falls within the felony range.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a drug crime. It could be, you know, some petty theft crime, but it's a crime nonetheless. And they've made their choice, and they've decided to go ahead and do that. So then the prosecutor can look over their criminal history, and if they don't feel it rises to the threshold and that this person is not really a threat to society, despite the fact that they continue to commit crimes, then they don't have to charge. If they do charge, then, as you said, the judge has the discretion as to whether or not they would sentence as a third strike.
Mm-hmm.
Then, if they fail both of those thresholds and they get sent to prison for 25 years to life for that third strike, then they have the appeals process that they can go through. So there's really three fail-safes there for them. There's the prosecutor, there's the judge, and there's the appeals process. And if after all of that, they find themselves serving 25 years to life, I think that there's a pretty good case that can be made that they're serving what they deserve to serve. Now, the opponents of three strikes, and this is what they said in the campaign, which was a very well-financed campaign in 2012, that it was always the intent of the people to make the third strike a serious and or violent crime, which is completely and totally untrue.
Not true, right.
It was never the intent of the people to do that. The intent of the people was to do exactly what they did. But because they had so much money, so much more money than the proponents of three strikes, they were able to convince enough people to overturn it and therefore make these 3,600 characters then eligible for immediate parole. And one of the things that they said, Tricia, when three strikes was passed, was that this was going to bankrupt the state, that it was going to put hundreds of thousands of people behind bars on the third strike, but at its highest, there were never more than 10,000 individuals that had been sentenced under the three strikes law. So you only had at the most 10,000 individuals serving 25 to life for three strikes. And quite frankly, here we are 20 years later, which means that we're coming up to a point where many of those individuals would ultimately have been eligible for parole nonetheless.
And didn't crime go down when the three strikes, because weren't they taking like these career criminals off the street, the gang leaders, they were able to stick them behind bars for a long time. Didn't the crime rate go down?
Well, it was based on the predicate, or it was predicated on the belief that a small percentage of individuals are committing a large percentage of crime. And if you get that small percentage off the streets, then you're going to positively affect the crime statistics in the state, and that's exactly what happened. You took the high crime committers and put them behind bars, and crime went down significantly. So everything they wanted to prove through three strikes, they were able to prove. But, you know, the pendulum swings both ways, and I guess we're heading in the other direction now.
Well, and what's scary about that, Mark, and you and I have talked about this before, is what's going to happen is innocent people now will have to suffer when these monsters are let out and are roaming the streets. And then what is Jerry Brown going to say? He put them out there. If there is any blood, it's on his hands, because he let, what was it, 1,400 lifers out already. Is that right? Is that the right number?
Yeah. That's since he became governor in 2011. That's correct.
Now, see, and that
this is the third initiative. This is the third initiative. This isn't the AB 109 Prison Realignment Initiative. This isn't the Three Strikes Initiative. This is the third one. This is something else entirely, and he's very clear that this has nothing to do with prison overcrowding in the state of California. This is just what he believes should be happening to to murderers.
And here's the thing.
When it comes down to it.
I guess that is exactly what he's saying, which is just shocking. But, Mark, here's the thing. I'm not a real big fan of the death penalty because I do think it is handed out unevenly. But I do also believe the only way you can guarantee that a monster won't kill again is through the death penalty, like the person that took away your wonderful daughter's life. That guy has no business roaming the streets because all he'll do is kill again. The only way to stop it until we can figure out as a society another way, the only way to stop it is to put them to death. Now, he's let out these 1,400 lifers, some of them, a lot of them probably murderers. What happens if they murder again? This will just prove our point. You can't give, when someone is a brutal murderer, they've shown you their true colors. You can't give them a second chance. They're going to go out and do it again, and an innocent person, how many innocent people have to die? Rhetorical question, totally, but absolutely true. And Mark, you're going to be there fighting the battle in California again when the crime rate starts to go up and when innocent people start to be murdered once again by these people that have been released. You'll be there, right?
Well, you know, it's not when, Tricia. The crime rates are already going up. There was a report put out by the FBI in early 2012 at the end of 2012 that stated very clearly that throughout the country, crime rates are going up, but they're going up faster in California than they are in other places, and that would be both property crime and violent crime. So, mm-hmm. You know, the writing's on the wall, and we're already starting to feel and see the repercussions of that. And every time you roll the dice for one of these characters and it comes up snake eyes, and then there's going to be another victim. And then, you know, I guess this government doesn't feel responsible for the victims. They only feel responsible for the price of incarceration.
Well, I'm wondering, and I'm certainly not making excuses. I'm just trying to see it from Jerry Brown's administration's point of view. If they're looking at it and thinking, okay, this guy, and I have no idea, it's just a thought, okay, this guy's in prison and he killed this guy in a bar fight, and he's done this, he's graduated from high school, he's got his college degree, he's done this and this and this, let's give him another chance. All that is well and good. And I see that line of thinking. However, people tend to behave when they're behind bars a lot better than when they're not. And that's the other thing to consider. Ted Bundy was fabulous behind bars. He was a great prisoner. And when they see how well someone's doing behind bars, it's because they can't go out and commit these crimes. And I don't understand why that can't sink into people. It's so obvious. Or am I just crazy?
Well, no, you're not crazy. I mean, the guy that killed Polly was rehabilitated when he was in prison, and certainly he had spent enough time in prison that he had plenty of opportunities for rehabilitation, but he got out of prison and was given a hell of a job paying over $16 an hour back in 1993 working in a machine shop, but it wasn't enough for him. He took off. You know, he worked there for mm-hmm. 6 weeks or something like that and decided he was better served kidnapping, raping, and murdering my daughter than being a productive member of society. So it's hard to make the case of rehabilitation for me.
Well,
I'm not
a
true believer in it. And we had a rehabilitative approach to prison for many years during the 60s and 70s. And much of the result of that was that in the 80s and 90s, we had escalating crime to the point where it became an epidemic.
Exactly, and I agree with you on rehabilitation. There are some people, you know, when we're not talking about murder or violent acts, of course there are people, especially people who are in there because of drugs. They're addicted to drugs, so they were stealing. There's all kinds of rehabilitation stories that I'm sure we could get into that do have a better ending. But when, again, when a maniac shows you their true colors, shows you that they can go out and get drunk and kill people and just create havoc, I don't care how well they do behind bars. I don't care. I don't want them out on the street. They've shown us their true colors, and I don't want to be anywhere near them. Mark, how has the media been? Because usually the media is on your side in California. They love what you do. They love it when you talk. Are they reporting any of these upturns in crime, or is it just kind of silent?
Well, media tends to be pretty liberal-minded, so they're not paying a lot of attention to this right now. I mean, locally, and I think this is everywhere in the country, locally, you're going to, the local news loves to put on the blood and gore stories in the evening news. I mean, that kind of drives the advertisement. That kind of drives it. But as far as trends go, as far as talking about statistics throughout the state goes, I don't think that you, or the causes of crime, I don't think that you get a lot of reporting along those areas. Listen, you know, you're going to be talking to somebody in a few minutes here, as I understand it, that's going to be talking about sociopaths. And I think that's really an important discussion, and it's one I think that follows very well from what we're talking about here because, you know, this business of lengthy incarcerations for certain people and making certain people register on Megan's Law or be sex offender registrants and have their information available on Megan's Law is pretty much based on the premise that there are certain individuals, and once we identify them, we need to protect ourselves from them.
Yes.
We need to protect ourselves from the sociopath / psychopath. And if that means keeping them behind bars for the rest of their lives, then so be it. We have to be able to protect ourselves from the pedophiles. We know that these guys aren't going to change their sexual orientation, and that whenever they are in society, that little boys and little girls are going to be potential victims. They become a very threatened population. Therefore, when we know who they are, we need to take steps to protect our kids against them. And finding some arbitrary line and saying, well, maybe this guy should only register for 10 years because, A, he hasn't been caught committing another crime, or, B, he hasn't committed another crime in those 10 years, it's certainly no guarantee that everybody or anybody is safe.
That is the truth, and once a sociopath, always a sociopath, and Donna
yep.
Anderson from lovefraud.com will be on here in just a moment to tell us that exact story, and the prison is full of sociopaths, and that's where they need to be, because
yeah.
they don't have that, it's in the brain, they don't have that frontal lobe, working connection that shows empathy, and they understand how, what it does to hurt somebody, they have no clue. Scott Peterson is a perfect example of somebody that has no ability to care. And the monster that killed Polly, same thing. So, Mark, it's an uphill battle. We'll help you any way we can. You know that. So we're here for you. Just call on us, and you have an army from all over the world to help you any way we can, okay?
Yeah, Web Sleuths rocks.
We do. Web Sleuths, it rocks. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, Mark.
You're
Give Violet my love, okay? Take care now.
All right.
Bye-bye. Yes, Web Sleuths rocks. I agree, 100%. Great people, great moderators. It is a wonderful place to be. And now on the phone with us, Donna, were your ears burning because we were talking about you? This is Donna Anderson from lovefraud.com. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much, Tricia.
Good. Well, Mark, I don't know if you were on the line when Mark said this, but he said that coming up, the discussion about sociopaths is very important as it relates to crime, because these sociopaths, when they commit a crime, they're not going to change. They can't change their orientation. It's like trying to change their eye color through talk therapy. It won't ever work, right?
That's exactly right. In fact, I did listen to part of your interview with Mark, and one of the best ways to predict whether or not someone who is imprisoned will recidivate, which means commit another crime after they get out, is to test them for psychopathy, which is another term for sociopath. There's a test called the PCLR, which stands for Psychopathy Checklist Revised, and it has been proven to be the best indicator of whether or not somebody will commit another crime when they get out of jail. If in Canada, all offenders are given this test, and that's how they determine whether or not someone gets paroled and or released in any other way. And if they get a high score on the PCLR, it's much more difficult for them to get out. And it always amazes me that this is not used as much in the United States, because it would go a long way towards predicting who is truly dangerous and who is not.
I wonder why that is. I wonder if it has something to do with anything with our laws. I'm not sure, because I can just see a defense attorney having a field day with this, saying, well, this is just a test, and it can be subjective. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. But, you know, how can we be reliable? We're talking about a man's life here. I mean, I can just hear the arguments in the defense lawyer's mind just going through everything. And I'm with you. It just, why not use this tool that's a proven tool that is used every day by psychiatrists and psychologists? I think it's ridiculous that we don't do that, and we should start doing it, and parole should be based on how they score on that test. Absolutely. Donna, we're kind of going a little bit bass-ackwards here. Let's introduce you. This is Donna Anderson from lovefraud.com. And Donna, can you give our listeners just a brief Reader's Digest version of why you started your website and what you intend to do with your website? It's a fascinating story.
Well, I was married to a con artist. This man took $250,000 from me. He cheated with 6 different women during our 2.5-year marriage. He had a child with one of those women, and then, 10 days after I left him, he married the mother of the child, which turned out to be the second time that he committed bigamy. Now, I could not make any sense out of his behavior at all until I learned that he was a sociopath. Because of my experience, I founded lovefraud.com to teach people how to recognize and recover from sociopaths, because literally millions of them live among us, and most people have absolutely no idea that these folks exist.
Now, that was quite the shortened version of your life story, but basically this man just turned your life upside down like a pillowcase and just shook it out. I mean, you lost everything, right?
Yes, I lost $250,000, and even though I was successful in the judge in my divorce finding that he was responsible for that loss and that he had a history of doing this, because I wasn't the man's only victim. During my divorce, I had 4 other women testify by phone that he had done the same thing to them. And even though I did get a judgment from the court for everything that was taken from me, plus $1,000,000 in punitive damages, I mean, I never got any of that money back. I collected a grand total of $517.
Oh my God! Oh jeez! Yeah. And where is he at? Where is he at now?
Well, he was originally from Australia, and even though when I met him, he lived near me here in New Jersey, it wasn't like I had this long distance relationship to Australia. But after I left him, he stayed in Florida. We were in Florida at the time, and then he left and started traveling internationally and spent some time in China and spent some time in New Zealand. And I actually tried to track him down. I hired international search agents to try and serve my judgment, and I was never able to do that. So I finally had to give up and declare bankruptcy. But about 5 years later, I was Googling him and going through page after page, because he has a common name, James Montgomery, so there were many pages of James Montgomery's, and I actually found him. He had returned to Australia, back in 2005, and he got a job. Now, the entire time that I knew him and the entire time that he was in the United States, he never had a real job. But here he was working at the Charles Sturt University in Bathurst, Australia, which is like this podunk town outside of Sydney. And so I found him. I was able to serve my judgment. And then what was really good was that at the same time, I had been in touch with an organization in Australia that investigates military frauds, because this man, when I met him, He claimed to be a veteran of the Vietnam War. He claimed that he had been a hero. He had gone on this mission and saved all these people, and for his bravery, he was awarded the congressional, or the Australian equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor, which is called the Victoria Cross. He had all this documentation to show me about his exploits. He claimed that he was 35 years in the military. He was still, when I met him years later, working for special forces and going on missions, and everything was fabricated. The man was never, ever in the military at all.
You know, I'm so disappointed to hear that he's from Australia, because I have this almost fantasy view of Australia, because I've been there, and everybody was so nice and so wonderful, and I just don't ever think of anybody being a criminal in Australia. They're just too damn nice, and now I know there's at least one sociopath. Well, he's probably the only one. Maybe not.
Well, oh, I don't want to ruin your fantasy, but unfortunately, sociopaths are everywhere. They are in all demographics, all societies, all through history. And these folks have been with us forever, and as a society, we've kind of had our blinders on. You know, people like to think that everybody is good inside and everybody is created equal and everybody just wants to be loved. And unfortunately, there is this subset of the population for which that simply is not true. I mean, these folks are predators, they're exploiters, and this is the way they live their lives.
Well, I just realized, in fact, it was Sword and Scale in our chat room said, isn't Australia a nation of criminals? That's right. They started, that's where England took all their criminals, Great Britain, and dumped them in Australia. I forgot about that. But they've turned nice now. But like you said, there are sociopaths everywhere in our lives, and we absolutely need to watch out for them. Let's talk, first of all, I want the definition of a sociopath, and then we're going to get into some of the signs. We talked a little bit about this on my Thursday show, but I wanted to spend more time and delve into it more deeply so people can see, because like you said, we want to believe people are nice, and a sociopath is so good at showing his really good side and his shiny, bright, sweet side that when they do something wrong, you believe them, and we need to stop that. Right now, when somebody does something really crazy and weird, we need to step back and say, is this person a sociopath or not? We need to investigate. So let's talk about the definition of a sociopath. What would that be?
I define a sociopath as a social predator. These folks spend their entire lives exploiting other people. Now, if you ask a mental health professional what the definition is, you'll get a variety of answers because the mental health profession has not agreed on what to call people who have this disorder or how to define this disorder. For example, there are like two separate camps. There's the camp of research psychologists who refer to these people as psychopaths. And then there's the camp of psychiatrists and therapists who use the DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual of the American Psychiatric Association, and they call the disorder antisocial personality disorder. The definitions are slightly different, so the people who use the term psychopaths say that they encompass 1% of the population, whereas the people who use the term antisocial personality disorder say it's 4% of the population. So somewhere between 1% and 4% is for this disorder. Now, besides that, there are a couple of other disorders that are very similar. One of them is narcissistic personality disorder, which can be about 6% of the population. And then there's borderline personality disorder, which is about 2% of the population. So if you add up the official estimates for all these different disorders, it's 12% of the population. So that's like 37 million people here in the United States, and that's an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is. That is very scary. And so they're kind of around every corner. Now, not all sociopaths are murderers. Tell us the statistic about, Fortune 500 CEO sociopaths. What is that statistic about how many there are in business?
Right. The man, Dr. Robert Hare, who is kind of the guru of psychopathy, he's the one who developed that test that I talked about earlier in the show, the Psychopathy Checklist Revised. Mm-hmm. According to his definition of a psychopath, he estimates that approximately 1% of the general population meets the definition. However, he and his associates have also done some research to test corporate executives, and what they found was that 3.5% of the corporate executives they tested fit the definition of a psychopath. So what that means is that there are 3.5 times as many psychopaths in corner suites as there are on the street.
That is scary, but not surprising at all, because you pretty much have to be somebody that doesn't take to heart when they have to destroy someone's career so your career can flourish. You know, that's why sociopaths are able to climb that corporate ladder. That makes perfect sense. Hey, I want to clear something up. Australia is not a nation of criminals. Back hundreds of years ago is when I was talking about when they dumped all the criminals there. That's when it was. They're wonderful people now. And I think there's only one sociopath from Australia, and that was the guy that you met, Donna.
Well, that's
I'm telling
not
you, they're the best people in Australia, the best. So anyway.
I agree. I went to Australia. In fact, that's where I got married, and I did mm-hmm. meet a lot of very friendly people. But there's a couple things you should be concerned about. First of all, sociopathy is genetic. So mm-hmm. if any of those folks who came over as convicts back in the 1800s had kids, which of course is kind of likely, there's a possibility that the genetics was passed down. And secondly, I do know that there's more than one sociopath, because I have readers in Australia, and I've heard the same horror stories from Australia as that I've heard everywhere else. So this condition is, I mean, I love Australia too. I had a great time when I was there, met some very nice people, but unfortunately, no segment of society is free of this disorder.
Okay, I'll believe you if it's, you say so, but dang, my bubble has just been burst. Anyway, let's talk about some of the signs of a sociopath. Now, you have a top 10 sign on your list, and I would encourage everybody to go to www.lovefraud.com, because this is Donna's website, and you'll spend hours on there. You will just keep going and going and going. So you have a list of top 10 signs to look out for. Here's, before we get into the top 10, you know, one of them is they ignore you when they're mad. Well, I know people that do that, and they're not sociopaths. How many of these 10 do we need to worry about before we think someone's really a sociopath? Because a lot of people have just one or two of them. That doesn't make them a sociopath. Do they have to have all 10?
Yes, pretty much so.
Okay.
I should be specific in that the top 10 list that I have is specifically for people who are involved in romantic relationships with sociopaths. In fact, this information is the foundation of my book, which is called Red Flags of Love Fraud, 10 Signs You're Dating a Sociopath. Now, sociopaths are in all aspects of society as well, so you might meet a sociopath through business, they might be your neighbor, they might be a family member, but the list that I've developed is specifically for folks who are dating a sociopath. And in answer to your question, there are 10. That's because this disorder is what they call a syndrome, and what that means is that it's a constellation of traits and behaviors that make up the disorder. So in order for somebody to be a sociopath, you pretty much have to see all the traits that are on my list.
Okay, good. We'll get to that list in 1 second. I do have a question. This is from Ricky in the chat room. Are sociopaths more likely to be kleptomaniacs or compulsive liars? Now, I know they're compulsive liars. That's how they get away with it all. But what about a kleptomaniac, someone who steals just for fun? Did you ever see that in a sociopath, or is that just kind of an oddball thing that might occur every once in a while?
I would say that being a kleptomaniac is not necessarily a symptom of being a sociopath. They certainly all lie. I mean, if someone is not lying, they are not a sociopath. But as far as stealing, yes, they will steal, but not necessarily by walking in a store and taking something off a shelf or something like that. Often, their method of choice is fraud. That's what a lot of sociopaths excel at, is that they convince you to give them your money or give them your property. But then again, not all sociopaths engage in theft and fraud either. I mean, some of them just engage in emotional abuse. So that's why it's important to look at all the different symptoms, because any particular sociopath can have any symptom or any trait to a varying degree. They're not all the same. In fact, the way that I describe it is that sociopaths range from sleazy to serial killer.
Right. You can have a sociopath that has never broken the law and is very successful, but they're just a terrible, horrible person, and they crush people who get in their way, and they lie and cheat and do all those things to get ahead. But you're absolutely right. So just because a sociopath isn't a criminal doesn't mean they're not dangerous to you, especially if you let one into your life. And let me ask you this, and again, we're going to get to the top 10, I promise, but I just keep coming up with these questions. Let's say somebody right now has a sociopath in their life. What is the best way to get rid of them?
You have to essentially end the relationship. A sociopath, unfortunately, once they are an adult, a sociopath will never change. So whatever this person is doing to you, this person will continue to do it to you as long as you allow it. So what needs to happen is that you need to end the involvement. And the best way to do that is to break it off very suddenly and have no further contact with that person afterwards.
You just got to, no matter how much they beg, steal, try and get in your life, you just got to keep shutting them down and hope they move on to someone else, because they will move on to someone else, and that's the sad thing about it. So, Ricky asked again, and this is a question we talked about on Thursday too, do they lie for no reason? And yeah, they do. They'll just make stuff up that there's no reason to lie about it, right?
Absolutely, that happens. In fact, there's a phenomenon that's called duping delight. And what that means is that some people, especially sociopaths, will lie just for the fun of it. I mean, they get a thrill out of pulling the wool over people's eyes. They get an adrenaline rush out of it. And so sociopaths will tell big lies, little lies, stupid lies. They'll lie when they'd be better off telling the truth. And they're just lying just to see if they can get away with it.
Right, almost like practice, I wonder sometimes if that's not it. Okay, let's get to your top 10 list. Now, are these in any particular order, like number 1 is the worst, number 10 is the least, or is it just all the same, all equally as bad?
It's not really in an order, although what I did notice is that the ones at the top of the list tended to be more common than the ones later down, but not by much. I mean, they're all pretty much equally weighted. I'll specify where I got this information. When I was writing my book, Red Flags of Love Fraud, I conducted 2 internet surveys of love fraud readers, and these were the people who had been victimized by the sociopaths in their lives. So I asked a bunch of questions, and they gave me their feedback. And these were good-sized surveys. I had more than 1,300 responses for each of them. So, you know, this is based on data collection among the love fraud readers, all of whom had been involved in one way or another with sociopaths. So the number one red flag is charisma and charm. And what that means is that sociopaths have this appealing energy about them. They seem to be very exciting. They're smooth talkers, they always know what to say, and they never miss a beat.
Okay.
The next one is what I call sudden soulmates. And what that means is when you get involved with a sociopath, you feel like you've found the person you've been waiting for all your life. And there's a very specific reason for this. The sociopath will study you, figure out what it is that you're looking for, and then make himself or herself into that person. And then when you start dating, you're like, oh my goodness, we have so much in common, we have all these shared values, we have the same outlook on life, and the sociopath will think it's a miracle and that you were just destined to be together.
And you know what's so sad about this? As you're describing this person, I'm thinking, oh, I'd never fall for that. And then when you really step back and think about it, you meet someone that's charming and wonderful and acts like they care about you. You know, you'd have to be a pretty cold piece of toast not to fall for that somewhat. So you just have to be really careful. I guess it's the amount of time. Like, it's almost immediate that they start you know, laying on the bologna. It's like just real quickly. Not, it's not a build-up to a relationship, right?
Most of the time that's true, but not always. And
okay.
That's the thing that your listeners need to keep in mind, is what I'm talking about generally is the what usually happens, but there are always exceptions. Like, for example, quite a few people contact me and say, you know, I've been involved with this person, and he fits all the traits of a sociopath, but he's never asked me for money. So does that mean that they're not a sociopath? And the answer could very well be yes, because not all sociopaths are out for financial gain from their partners. There are plenty of sociopaths, especially those who are those corporate executives that we talked about. I mean, they're not looking for money, you know, but they can still have the absolute disregard for your emotional and psychological well-being that makes them a sociopath.
Got it. Okay, so that was number two. So we're on number three?
Number three is sexual magnetism. If you feel this intense attraction, and if your physical relationship is unbelievable, it could be the sociopath's excess testosterone. Because all sociopaths, both male and female, have very high levels of testosterone.
And that's something that we found that I just find absolutely amazing. It's a definite clue to someone being a sociopath is if they have a high level of testosterone, both male and female. That's fascinating. Do they know why that is? Do they have any idea?
It has to do with the brain chemistry of this disorder, and I have a colleague by the name of Dr. Leanne Leadham, who is a psychiatrist and who is researching this disorder, and she has some theories about how the brain works and how people, you know, how the disorder develops. Like, one of the main things is that for most people, I mentioned before that it is highly genetic, and what that means is that it can a child can be born with a predisposition to become a sociopath, and it's possible to try and prevent that from happening through parenting, but sometimes it doesn't work. But what happens is that usually this disorder really starts to kick in around puberty. So people tend to see it when, you know, kids are 11, 12, 13, 14, you know, in that age range is when they, in some cases, very subtly start to take on this whole different personality. And the reason for that is because that's when the testosterone kicks in.
Oh, my gosh, that is just so bizarre. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that would have been a problem? Anyway, I'm sorry. So that's number three. Okay, so we're on number four, right?
Yes, number four is love bombing. And what that means is that when you get involved with a sociopath, this person will absolutely shower you with attention. They will want to be with you all the time. They'll call and text and email constantly, and they'll put you on this pedestal and make you feel like the most important person in the world. In fact, that's one of the things that really makes people think that the person is actually in love with them because, you know, normally when you're dating somebody, you know, you're both kind of cautious in the beginning and kind of feeling each other out and, you know, not really revealing your heart or wearing your heart on your sleeve. Well, a sociopath comes along and just sweeps you off your feet and tells you how wonderful you are and says you're the person he's been waiting for or she's been waiting for all their life. And most of us have never experienced anything like it. So, in fact, like in my case, I mean, I had dated for a long time. I was 40 years old when I met my ex-husband. And this guy starts telling me how wonderful I am, and he's been waiting for me. And I mean, I had dated a lot of guys, and I never saw anything like it. So, you know, you think it's true. I mean, you think that this person is just smitten with you, and that's the reason that they're so head over heels, when in reality, it's a technique. It's love bombing. This is what they do.
Oh, that's just so Scott Peterson. I know I keep going back to Scott Peterson, but he is such an example to me of a sociopath and love bombing. Look what he did to Amber Fry. And that is actually Amber Fry. I'd love to have her on my show. I've been trying to get in touch with her, and I don't know if she's going to do it or not, but she would be interesting to hear how he did just love bomb her to no end. I mean, he went so far as to find out what type of apple she liked in a caramel apple. she liked a Pink Lady apple, and he went and made that apple for her, and things like that, where she's just like, wow, that's amazing. So, again, everybody listening, if you're hearing this and it's ringing true, be very, very careful. Okay, so now we are on number four, Jekyll and Hyde, right?
We're on number five.
Number five, sorry.
And it's, Jekyll and Hyde is at the end of the line, but we'll get there. Number five is that the sociopath blames other people for everything that goes wrong. Nothing is ever their fault. They don't take any responsibility. If something goes wrong, it's always because somebody else is out to get them. Somebody else didn't do what they were supposed to do. Somebody else didn't follow through. Now, this is really important sign because you notice that the first four that we talked about all sounded pretty good. I mean, we talked about charisma and charm and your sudden soulmate and sexual magnetism and love bombing. I mean, you know, if you're on the receiving end of that, it seems wonderful. But if you also start to see someone who's blaming other people and not taking responsibility, now you're starting to see the negative signs. So it's very important that if you start to see this combination to pay attention.
Very true. Very true. Okay, so that's number five. Now we're on number six.
And that is lies and gaps in the story. We talked about lying before. All sociopaths lie. If somebody isn't lying, they're probably not a sociopath. And they just, the lies are unbelievable. I mean, sometimes they are so outrageous that you cannot comprehend that somebody would make such a lie. For example, when my ex-husband was telling me that he had been awarded the Victoria Cross for his heroism in Vietnam, I could not conceive of somebody telling me that and it not being true.
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, they are sometimes so outrageous that it has to be true, because who would have the nerve to lie about something like that? And another technique that they do is that they manage to mix in enough truth with the lies so that you can't tell where the truth ends and the lies start. And that makes it very confusing, because you know some of the things that they're saying are true, so you assume that the rest of what they're saying is true.
Exactly. And I bet you, Donna, there are people out there right now that are going, oh, my God, it's true. I mean, this is probably an eye-opener for a lot of people. That's why it's so important. Okay, so we're on number seven. This is interesting. I never thought this would be a problem, but intense eye contact, right?
Yes. You could refer to this as the predatory stare. Sometimes if you're in the presence of a sociopath, you'll get the feeling that they're like sizing you up for their next meal in a hopefully figurative sense, or you may get the idea that they're like staring right through you, and like you might start get chills or flutters in your stomach or the hair on the back of your neck standing up. Any of these are warning signs. And the important thing about the intense eye contact is that it's about the only physical sign that somebody might be a sociopath. And in my survey data, about 60% of the respondents said that they saw this, that, you know, the person had this blank look sometimes. And I refer to it as shark eyes. You know, sometimes you look at somebody and there's, like, nobody home. And so that is important, because it might be a physical symptom that you're dealing with someone who's a predator.
Got it. Got it. Oh, and sociopaths lie to therapists all the time, like they're saying in the chat room. That's why it's impossible to treat them, right?
Well, first of all, most sociopaths will not willingly go to therapy because they don't think that anything's wrong with them. I mean, from their point of view, they're superior. They're the ones who, you know, can have the nerve to do whatever they want and say whatever they want, and they're not hindered by a conscience or emotions or any sense of integrity. So, you know, they look down on the rest of us stupid sheep who worry about, like, being good to people and everything. So they rarely, practically, almost never will go into therapy thinking that there's something wrong with them. There's only two real cases where a sociopath will go to therapy. One is if a partner drags them in, and the other is if they're court-ordered. And in either of those cases, sociopaths will just turn on the charm and snow the therapist as well. I mean, that happens all the time.
Exactly, yeah. It would be very difficult, I would think, for a therapist to really diagnose a sociopath unless they showed those tendencies, like you said, and they took the test. But that's why I can't imagine a sociopath going to therapy at all. And all they would do is lie. So we're on, we had intense eye contact. Where are we at? Move fast.
We're on number 8.
One?
Yep.
Is that
move fast
okay.
to hook up. And right. what that means is the sociopath usually will sweep you off your feet in this whirlwind romance. They will quickly proclaim how much they love you, how you're the perfect person, you're a perfect couple. They'll start talking about getting married, moving in together, having a baby, and sailing off into the sunset. And the reason they tend to move quickly is because they want to get their hooks into you before you escape.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's another one to watch out for. Okay, number 9.
This is the pity play. A sociopath will appeal to your sympathy. They'll want you to feel sorry for their abusive childhood or their psycho ex-wife or their crazy boss. But, mm-hmm. of course, you know, since they lie all the time, this may or may not be true about the other person. In fact, I've talked to quite a few love fraud readers who got some song and dance from the sociopath about the sociopath's ex and what a terrible person this was and psycho and mentally unstable and everything else. And then, you know, for some reason they actually meet the person and find out that, you know, she's not like that at all. That, you know, mm-hmm. the sociopath is just saying this stuff.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. It's just you telling this list already in my mind. I know the people in my life that I've dealt with. I can tell which ones that have been sociopaths. If only I had this list before I met them. Okay, continue on. We're on number, I'm sorry, I forgot.
All right.
What number are we on?
Now we're on number 10, the Jekyll and Hyde personality. And,
right.
And what that means is that, you know, one minute the sociopath loves you, the next minute they hate you. They change like you flipped a switch, and you have absolutely no idea what caused the change.
And they just, out of the blue, well, just all of a sudden they're mad at you, and nothing you can do can fix it, right?
That is exactly what happens. And that's an important point, is that one of the hard lessons that love fraud readers who are involved with sociopaths eventually learn is that nothing they do makes any difference. You know, the sociopath is going to behave the way the sociopath is going to behave, and it doesn't matter, you know, because the sociopath keeps changing the rules. So, you know, if the sociopath tells you, you know, well, let's have a quiet discussion about this, and you start to have a quiet discussion, the sociopath will, you know, say, well, wait a minute, you know, I don't want to talk about this at all, you know, or something. And it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you say. They're going to do what they're going to do.
And that's right. And they'll change it around so everything is your fault no matter what you do. Now, we have been talking about sociopaths, and I've been using the term he. But female sociopaths, scary. Scary bunch. Let's talk specifically about female sociopaths. But before we do, we're talking with Donna Anderson. Donna is explaining to us, she is teaching us how to watch out for a sociopath so we won't get caught up in a sociopath's life and then have to deal with all the aftermath, because it will be horrendous. Check out her website at lovefraud.com. Okay, Donna, female sociopaths, is there any difference other than one's a male, one's a female? Do they behave differently? Are they more dangerous? What's up with females?
Well, first of all, there are both male and female sociopaths. There are generally considered to be more male sociopaths than female sociopaths, and that's a function of essentially the differences between male and female brains. The disorder tends to affect males more than it affects females.
Mm-hmm.
On many measures, the females are exactly the same. Probably about the only real difference is that some of them are not as violent. You know, there are males who are violent, and there are males who are not violent, and there are females who are violent, but tends to be less so. You know, typically women are just less violent than men, although there are certainly female murderers and, you know, people who have gone into relationships where they think, you know, hitting and kicking and scratching
right.
is typical part. So what tends to happen is that they tend to be far more manipulative. Of course, males are manipulative, but females tend to be more manipulative. So And another key sign or way that you can figure out if someone, if a woman is a sociopath, is how they treat their children, because female sociopaths essentially don't care about their kids. You know, they can be abusive to their children. They torture their exes or the kids' fathers in order, you know, and use the kids as a club to try and rattle the father. So people who grow up with a sociopathic mother really struggle, and it affects them for their entire lives.
And that leads me to another question that came from the chat room, which is an excellent question. What if you are a child of a sociopath? When should you, I mean, boy, that's a tough one, because by the time you're 20 or 21 and realize it, it's like the damage is done. I'm throwing my hands up in the air. What can we do if a sociopath has a kid? Raise them to be screwed up.
Well, yes and no. Every case is different, and there are plenty of people who do have sociopathic parents who are certainly injured by the experience and damaged, but still have a core of a good person and a whole person inside them. So there's a couple of things. One of the things that a lot of children of sociopaths struggle with is the idea that they should still continue to be involved and care about their parents, even though the parents are sociopaths. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I would say they need to let go of. You know, we're all taught to honor our mother and father, but that is only if the mother and father are honorable. You know,
right.
if someone has, you know, been torturing you and abusing you and emotionally and psychologically damaging you all your life, I don't think anybody in that situation should feel obligated to maintain a relationship with the parent or take care of the parent in their old age or anything like that, you know, because the healthiest thing you can do is break off the relationship with the parent. You know, it's not good for you. And, you know, the only way that you can really recover is to have the person out of your life. And then what you can do after that is, you know, take steps to recover from the damage. You know, you see a good therapist, you know, learn how to release the pain and release the disappointment and the anger and the rage over your experience, because it's keeping it inside that continues to damage you. So if you can figure out a way to get it out of your system and to replace that damage with good experiences and joyful experiences, then you can work your way towards healing.
Boy, you know, that's a real tough one, though, Donna, because let's say, you know, you have a cousin or someone that's a former friend, and you know they're a sociopath, and you know they're abusing their kids verbally and emotionally. What can you do? Child Protective Services is already overloaded with physical cases. I don't know what you can do other than to try and befriend the child and let them know that, hey, this is not how parents act. I don't know. Any thoughts?
Well, actually, your suggestion is about the best thing that you can do, because when a child is in that situation, if there is one adult that they know they can count on, that this adult will be there for them and will be an anchor and, you know, will help pick up the pieces, it really makes a difference in a child's life. So, you know, if you do know someone, a child who is experiencing this, if there's a way that you can befriend the child, that can help. It can help indeed.
Yeah, that is true. I once asked a therapist, how come is it that sometimes kids grow up in really dysfunctional families, and they grow up to be normal, and other kids grow up to be drug addicts or whatever. And he said he can always tell because there was an adult in that child's life that stepped in, be it a teacher, a neighbor, and they were able to look to that adult for true behavior and good behavior rather than to their parents. So I think it's important not to be afraid to step in. That doesn't mean you have to interfere and get all involved in their lives, but just let that child know that, hey, you're a great kid, and, you know, come talk to me about school, and I think it's wonderful. Set an example of being a decent human being, and that will really help a child understand that their parent or parents are not normal, and that isn't normal, and they don't need to feel guilty about cutting them out of their lives. Totally agree with that. So how long ago was this that this happened, and when did you start your website, Donna?
Well, I actually met my ex-husband back in 1996, and I was only with him for 2.5 years, so my divorce was finalized in 2000. And then it took me a few years to kind of, you know, get back on my feet and also to develop the website. So the website launched in 2005. So that means it's almost 9 years old. And mm-hmm. in this time, I have always invited people to contact me and tell me their stories of being involved with a sociopath. So as of now, I've collected more than 5,000 cases of people who've been involved
wow.
with a sociopath.
And that is just the tip of the iceberg, which is really sad. It's very, very sad. Do you foresee in the future, I always like to think of the future and in a scientific way, that maybe somehow we'll be able to help a sociopath kind of make those connections in his brain that they're missing. Is there any studies or anything being done to see how we can cure or perhaps even reshape a sociopath?
Actually, there are. And the most hopeful cases are those in which a therapist is able to start working with a child when young, or even the parents start working with a child when young. What often happens, especially among love fraud readers, is that, you know, they're involved with this person, and the person is making them nuts, and they've had a child with this person, and then they come to love fraud and realize, oh, my God, you know, this person is a sociopath. So then, by reading Love Fraud, they also realize that there is a chance that the child may have inherited the genetics of a sociopath. Mm-hmm. So when that happens, the best thing that can be done is for the parents to act as though the child is at risk and to parent the child appropriately. Now, what that means is that a child who is at risk of developing this disorder essentially is not born with an ability to love. And that's the key to the disorder. The sociopath does not have the ability to love. But mm-hmm. if you get a child young enough, you can actually teach that ability. You can teach the person empathy. You can teach the person to experience guilt. And, you know, so if you start working with somebody at a young age, there's a chance that you can do it so that, you know, the disorder never develops. So that's one thing. Now, the other thing that's really very interesting is that there's a whole new type of investigation going on into a field known as epigenetics. And what that means is that it's that things happen that are above the genes. There's new research that shows that genetics is not permanent. In other words, it's not, if you have the genes for something, that doesn't mean that it's carved in stone, and mm-hmm. that experience can actually influence how the genes develop. So, you know, there's a lot of new stuff that's very exciting that I think gives me a lot of hope. Not only for, you know, for people who are sociopaths, but for all kinds of issues that, you know, seem to be genetic in nature.
Sure.
And, you know, so I think it's possible. I think that people need to be open-minded as far as some of these new types of brain sciences and energy psychology and things like that are concerned, because it could really make a big difference.
Well, that is good news. I didn't expect to hear that, so I'm glad that something is at least attempting to be done right now, because it certainly needs to be. Donna, tell us about your book again. It's been out for a little bit, but what's the name of it?
Well, I have two books.
Uh-huh.
My first book is actually called Love Fraud, How Marriage to a Sociopath Fulfilled My Spiritual Plan. And that tells my personal story, and it reads like a cross between a true crime novel and a spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. So the second book is called Red Flags of Love Fraud, 10 Signs You're Dating a Sociopath, and that's totally different. It's an out-and-out self-help book. I explain what a sociopath is. I go through a lot of the traits that I talked about. I tell you how you how a sociopath goes about seducing you, how to get out of the involvement. And the book also has lots and lots of anecdotes from the research that I did.
Fantastic. And you can get those at Amazon.com or go to lovefraud.com and check out Donna Anderson's amazing website. Donna, thank you so much. I'm sure we'll be coming back to you more and more as we delve into more and more true crime. There's going to be more and more sociopaths. So thank you for your help and for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Donna Anderson, do not forget to check out her website. I am telling you, it is so great. It's lovefraud.com. Okay, kids, that wraps it up. Don't forget, this Thursday, iHeartRadio, I'll be tweeting out the link here in a little bit, and I'll post it everywhere. It's in their Extreme Talk radio section on iHeartRadio.com. Thursday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 90% sure I'm going to have this amazing captain. He is a pilot, but he's a captain, and he's has a big voice, and he's just brilliant, and he's wonderful. And he said he's 90% sure, so I'm 90% promoting the fact that he will be there Thursday to talk about the missing airliner and all the questions that we have about it. We have a million, and we're going to keep him on the air till he answers every single one of them. Okay, don't hesitate to join us on Thursday and every Sunday night. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio. Do not forget that Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by the wonderful people at Paws for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Paws for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. Go to www.pauseforpurpleheartsorg. And do remember, please, that the opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com, LLC. That's it for this week, my friends. We'll see you next week with Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.